We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover. Starting, as usual, with local and people's rents going up.
Yeah, it's summertime, and this time of year, it's apartment roulette. People are moving like crazy, and rents are going up. Apartment Insights, which is an industry newsletter, did a study of rents in King and Snohomish County. And what they found is that rents have gone up an average of 5.8% from last year and 3% just from last month alone. In King County, the vacancy rates are now down to 4.31%. 5% is considered an even market that doesn't favor either the landlord or the tenants. On Capitol Hill, the average rent is now $1,395 per month. That's up 8.2% from last year. Downtown Seattle average rent is $1,707 per month. That's up 3.1% from last year. And even though new buildings are opening up, there are new tech jobs at Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. That's their explanation for why rents are going up. However, I think there are some other reasons because, you know, there may be more tech jobs and there may be more apartments opening up, but there are also a lot of condos going on the market for rent because they're not being sold. I think the rates really are being driven not by demand so much as by the computer algorithms that landlords use to try to figure out how much rent the market will bear.
Especially the big national property holders.
Yeah, and once they post their rents, and a lot of them post them online when they advertise their apartments for rent, then smaller landlords can easily look online and get a sense for what the average rent is in their neighborhood for what they assume will be a comparable unit, and they jack their rents up as well. Also, we can't discount the impact of inflation. Inflation has been kind of mildly in the news, but I've noticed it over the last year or more, inflation in food prices as well as in rent. Certainly, rents have gone up over the last 3 years.
And those are the sort of things that are not actually reflected in the consumer price index. So
yeah.
We don't hear about it.
And landlords, too, are also trying to very quickly and very steeply make up for 3 or 4 years of stagnation in rents that happened around the time of the economic downturn. So I think that's what's really driving the rental increases more than anything.
All right. Moving on. Other happy news, the transportation bill that wasn't.
Yeah, we're just full of good cheer this morning. We talked about this a little bit last week because we hadn't gotten a final word yet on the close of the legislative session in Olympia. But the Republican-controlled Senate, as we predicted last week, failed to pass a transportation bill to match the one that was passed by the Democrat-controlled House. And therefore, several things happened with that. Of most concern locally is that there was no measure power, or in this case rider, passed by, no pun intended, passed by the Senate and therefore also by the House and signed and put into law that would allow King County voters to vote to extend the tax that has been used to partially fund Metro for the past couple of years. And so, as we've been talking about for a number of months, there will be, unless Jay Inslee calls a special session to deal with this, a 17% budget cut for Metro and steep cutbacks, which Metro has already announced to a number of routes around the county. This is something that happened not because of any particular single policy decision. It's because one of the two houses in Olympia was controlled, even though they didn't have the numerical advantage in terms of the party. That wasn't something the voters did, but was controlled by the Republican Party. And the Republican Party at this point in Washington State is dominated by people who, number one, don't believe in public transit. Number two, don't believe in taxes. And in this case, even extending to the ability of allowing people to vote on whether they want to tax themselves extra to pay for a service. And number three, don't believe in Seattle. Because it's full of like liberals and stuff. The antipathy toward public transit can also be seen in that they also, one of the other effects of not passing the transportation bill was it killed the massive Columbia River Crossing project down connecting Vancouver to Portland. And what that has been all about, for people who haven't been following that, since it's a really a more a Portland story than a Seattle or Washington State story, is that Oregonian voters wanted, and Multnomah County and Tri-County area politicians wanted, to include light rail, an extension of Portland's very successful light rail system across that bridge. And again, Republican legislators in Washington State were ideologically opposed to including rail capacity in that bridge. So that is now dead too.
Yeah, one of the things I find interesting is Republicans talk about how, you know, it's a waste of money to put money into transit and they hate it so much. Well, you know, they should be down in San Francisco right now during the BART transit strike, and they should be experiencing the absolute gridlock of an additional almost half a million people in their cars trying to get to work because the BART trains are not running. This is what happens when you decide to gut and cut transit, is you get something that not just impacts everybody's everyday life or their commute to work, it will really impact commerce too, something that the Republicans claim to be the spokesman for.
And at the same time, we did talk about this last week, that the compromise budget that was arrived at, because again of the Republican intransigence in the Senate, wound up putting money, probably not enough, but at least some additional money into K-12 education this year, which they were required to do by the state Supreme Court's decision. But they took it in part from the state's capital fund. So they took it from infrastructure that, among other things, benefits roads and bridges. So they're not actually even supporting the car culture that they're all insistent about trying to underwrite. So it's really kind of poor public policy all the way around.
Yeah, that fund that they're taking money from in order to balance the state's budget is not just for roads and bridges.
No,
it's also for other infrastructure, particularly for small localities. We're talking about small towns and rural communities that don't have the tax base and don't have the wealth in their general area to tax themselves in order to pay for things like sewer replacement and replacement water sources and other types of utility projects, as well as roads and bridges. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those areas, rural areas and small towns, are vote heavily Republican. So the Republicans really are shooting themselves in the foot by having done that.
Yeah, there's this sort of myth that's put forward in conservative parts of the state that, you know, they're underwriting Puget Sound economically and they pay out far more in taxes and so forth. It's actually just the opposite.
It's the reverse.
Because the rest of the state is less densely populated, the amount of infrastructure the amount of money that's required per person to keep the infrastructure maintained, whether it's utilities or dams or roads and bridges or whatever it might be, is quite a bit higher. And, you know, because the economy here is much stronger and there's a lot more money in the Seattle area,
yes, exactly.
The amount of money that is used to underwrite the rest of the state, the outflow is quite a bit. And, you know, let's be honest that there is a lot of antipathy, in the rest of the state and their legislative delegations towards Seattle. And that is a fair amount of what motivates, a legislature when you have, you know, the Seattle and King County delegations primarily, with the conspicuous exception of Rodney Tom, you know, begging and pleading with the Senate to just allow people to vote on Metro, where they're just saying, you know, screw Seattle. We don't care. You know, it's your problem. It's what you deserve for being Seattle.
All right.
And it also doesn't help that Seattle's leadership, I mean, the city of Seattle in this case, has had, at least for the last couple of mayors, terrible relationships with Olympia as well.
Grocery store workers.
Yeah, we talked a few weeks ago about fast food workers going out on a one-day walkout to protest working conditions and demand unionization and such. This week it was grocery workers' turn. This past Wednesday, Puget Sound grocery workers from Albertsons, Safeway, QFC, and Fred Meyer. Those are the three companies, because QFC and Fred Meyer are owned by the same company, Kroger. Those three companies dominate the mainstream grocery business in the Puget Sound area. They walked out on behalf of 30,000 Teamsters and UFCW employees. They've been working without a contract for months, and according to the unions, the managers are pressing for a new deal that would, among other things, eliminate health care coverage for a lot of the workers, cut holiday pay, offer no wage increases, and take away paid sick days for Seattle workers, which obviously are now covered under the new sick leave law, and forbid other workers in the region from having that perk as well. And of course, you know, the idea that something that is covered under local law should be considered a perk. I mean, it's, you know, why is that even negotiable in the first place? But, you know, this comes in the context of an industry that's fairly profitable. They've had some rising costs, particularly around transportation. But, you know, again, when you have, you know, rising food prices, which talking about inflation, most people are aware of as well. And I wouldn't say a monopoly, but certainly there's only a handful of companies that dominate the business in terms of the big box stores. You know, they're making money fine, but they're once again trying to whittle back the wages and working conditions and benefits of and job security of a lot of the workers, and workers are fighting back against that.
And hotel workers.
Yeah, on the bright side, a reminder that unionization can in fact work, and not being organized very often doesn't work very well. Unite here, the hotel hotel employees and restaurant employees, the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union, they reached a tentative contract agreement this week with the Hilton Hotel chain. That was a national agreement, but there's been a lot of the activity around that in Seattle over the past few years. Hilton has been non-unionized for many, many years, and there's been a union boycott and such. They reached an agreement this week, and that will affect Seattle workers as well, and I guess Paris will have a little bit less to spend on their next rehab stint, so it's all good.
Perfect. Moving on to nationals, starting with the cost of maternity care.
Yeah, this is the time of year, you know, when there isn't a whole lot going on in politics and scandal and all that kind of stuff. And so the newspapers, mainstream press, starts to write about the issues that matter to people. And you actually
the things that they should be writing about
fairly,
all along.
Yeah, you get some fairly decent stories. Well, this week, the New York Times had a couple of them. One of them was titled American Way of Birth, Costliest in the World. And it was about the cost of having a baby in the U.S. versus in other developed countries where you get a comparable level of care. It's not that we get better care in the U.S. and that we're paying for better care. It's that we get the same care and we are paying way more, not just double, but not just triple, but on an order of 10 to 11 times more than other countries do. In the U.S., the cost of having a baby could run you from $4,000 to $45,000 or more if you have any kind of complications that are involved. Now, maternity and newborn care is the single biggest category of hospital payouts for both Medicaid and private insurers. I'm going to say that again. Maternity and newborn care is the single biggest category for hospital payouts for both Medicaid and for private insurers.
I was going to say, if it's Medicare, there's been some interesting
medical
breakthroughs.
Sorry, not Medicare. Medicaid, yeah. we're not able to help people on Medicare. Elderly people have children. No, anyway, in the U.S., there are about 4 million births per year, and the total cost for those 4 million births is about $50 billion. Which makes up a huge part of healthcare spending in the U.S. Now, the average price for a vaginal delivery with no complications in the U.S. is about $30,000. In other developed countries, it can be, for example, in Ireland, it's free for maternity care. All maternity care in Ireland is free. In Switzerland, France, and Netherlands, they can charge up to about $4,000, but that's the upper limit. They can't charge you more than that. For a birth, if you have a C-section with your delivery here in the United States, it can run about $50,000 on average, or more if there are other complications involved. Costs in the U.S. have tripled since 1996, and they have increased by 49% just in the last 6 years. Now, the majority of women, about 62% of women who have insurance, but that insurance is not provided by an employer. In other words, they've had to buy it on the private market. Those women entirely lack coverage for the birth of a child. So the majority of women who don't get their insurance through an employer and have to buy a private policy, usually they have to buy a policy that doesn't have coverage at all for maternity care. So they have to pay that $50,000 out of pocket.
They can't possibly claim that it's a pre-existing condition.
Oh, no. No, that's true. And and if you really think about it, it's sexual discrimination. Because nobody tells men, well, we're not gonna cover basic health care, certain basic health care for you. I also want to point out that new mothers in European countries often stay in a hospital for up to a week after the birth of a child in order to heal, to rest up, and to learn how to breastfeed. Here in the United States, women are often kicked out of the hospital the next day because insurance companies don't want to pay for the hospital room. Why is it so much more expensive in the United States? Well, there's no big mystery about that. Doctors and hospitals in other countries receive a flat fee for each birth. So they provide a standard set of services that are, in some cases, better than the set of services provided here in the United States. On the other hand, here in the U.S., you get charged for every little service and supply. For example, you might be charged $20 for a little bit of antiseptic, you know, when you can buy a whole bottle of the stuff for $3 down at the drugstore. Hospitals have an incentive. Hospitals and doctors both have an incentive, therefore, to push for more blood tests, more sonograms, more screenings, more doctor visits, and even more C-sections, more IVs, more drugs, and more induced labors than are medically necessary because they can charge you for them, and that's how they make their profit. So that's one of the reasons why U.S. maternity care is so much more, by factors of 10 or more, expensive than in other developed countries. It really is a broken system.
One of the things that's fascinating about life on the border down in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas is that you have this weird back and forth that goes on among new members, mothers rather, because you have expectant mothers on the Mexican side that want to come to the U.S. to have their babies, so the babies will have U.S. citizenship. But new mothers on the American side go to Mexico because they have a much more developed system of midwifery there, which is traditional in Latin culture.
Which is cheaper, and many people believe it's healthier for the mother and the baby.
Exactly correct on both of those scores. And just in general, even if it's a hospital delivery, it's much cheaper in Mexico as well. Again, for this, you know, relatively similar type of care.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to what very well may become a regular segment, Surveillance State Watch.
Yeah. The other interesting article that the New York Times ran this week that, you know, in their downtime, was an article entitled U.S. Postal Service Logging All Mail for Law Enforcement. It was an article about the Mail Isolation Control and Tracking Program, something that is relatively new. There was an old program that's been around for hundreds of years, really, in the United States, probably since the birth of the country, called Mail Covers, where the mail service would take down data from the outside of the envelopes, or in the modern era, photocopy the outside of all envelopes going to certain people who were on a list, usually criminals or political dissidents. That's been going on for a long time. And in order to open people's mail, the government would have to get a warrant in order to open and search people's and read people's actual mail. The Mail Isolation Control and Tracking Program, on the other hand, involves computers photographing the outside of every single envelope processed by the U.S. mail every single day. That's collecting metadata on your physical mail. And so now, instead of just having a list of suspected criminals and political dissidents, now they assume every single person in the United States is a potential criminal and or political dissident and or terrorist. Now, in addition, there's no warrant required for opening your mail. George W. Bush, in a presidential signing statement in 2007, wrote that the U.S. government can open your mail without a warrant in an emergency, and that's a fairly vague statement, or if it involves, quote-unquote, foreign intelligence. And I have to tell you, that's been going on for more than just the last 5 or 6 years. That's been going on for a couple of decades at least. I used to live with a person who got mail regularly from Finland, and his mail was never sealed. It always came open.
One of the One of the things that occurs to me is that, you know, we know that there was an enormous amount of felonious material, felonious activity engaged in by big banks over the past number of years. Does this mean that every single credit card solicitation gets logged that they send out?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it does.
That's like trillions.
Mm-hmm. I thought I read in an article that it was like 160 billion items a year.
Oh, it's a lot. Yes, yeah. It is a lot.
How many of those anymore are even private correspondence?
Yeah, I know.
All right. Let's move on. Incredible number of wildfires this last week.
Yeah. You know, we've been hearing about the wildfires going on in the West from New Mexico all the way north through Idaho, including the disaster in Arizona, the Yarnell fire that killed 19 firefighters this past week and has burned more than 8,000 acres. What we haven't been hearing is what the potential cause for all of these wildfires are. Yeah, sure, it's summertime, and yes, sure, it's dry, but wildfires used to come in August, not in June.
And they used to be really bad once every few years rather than every year.
Has
happened for the past several.
Yeah, and it doesn't take a scientist to be able to figure out that global warming is responsible, that when you have warmer winters, you have less snowfall and more rain. Rain doesn't stick around and slowly melt into the ground, leaving the soil more moist longer into the summer. It flows away in rivers and streams, and so you have soils drying out faster in May and June. And also the growing season starts earlier when the winters are warmer, and so there's a lot more stuff around to burn. And the two of those together, along with a lot of people moving into fire-prone zones that where they didn't used to live, that just creates this huge problem. In addition, we also have the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is a regional climate pattern, has also swung into its dry cycle. So that means not just droughts caused by global warming, but also droughts caused by a regular regional, exacerbated by the regular regional weather pattern.
And there's another piece of this also that hasn't been covered in news coverage of this, which is that the Forest Service teams that are fighting these fires have been decimated by sequestration.
Yes.
Along with many other things
in
the federal government,
cuts.
Of course, the federal budget cuts that they required them to cut 20-30%, depending on the part of the country, from their firefighting teams. And so, for example, when you had the disaster in Arizona that wiped out an entire elite unit, there was nobody relatively close on hand to replace them, because everybody had been laid off. So it's you know, you really wonder about the policies of policymakers, that they are sitting on their thumbs and doing absolutely nothing about climate change. And we saw just last week with President Obama's executive decisions on climate change that they got almost no media coverage at all. Very little attention, and his hands are tied by Congress's inability to do anything on the issue, because we have an entire political party that doesn't believe that the world is round or something. But so you have that on the one hand, and then on the other hand, when we get these impacts of climate change that are actually happening on the ground right now that affect agriculture, they affect things like fires, they're affecting all sorts of different aspects of our economy. Our policies are ignoring all that.
All right. Speaking of ignoring policies, the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, the Obama administration this last week announced a delay in the requirement for large companies to provide health insurance under the new Affordable Care Act. Large employers with more than 50 employees are required to provide health insurance for their employees, or else pay a $2,000 penalty per person. That's kind of interesting, because even though they're delaying that requirement for a year, they're not delaying the requirement that people have insurance or pay a penalty, which means the employees whose employers don't currently provide insurance for them, and who are not sure whether their employers are going to provide that insurance, are going to have to go to the healthcare exchanges and buy their own private insurance. And there could be a big mess as to how those exchanges are going to tell whether or not that person qualifies to buy discounted insurance or not, or whether that person can, whether their employer does actually provide it or not. And
so it winds up being a massive gift.
It
becomes a massive gift, not just for corporate America, but for the insurance companies that are going to benefit as well.
Yeah.
All right. Stop and frisk.
Yeah, didn't get a whole lot of news coverage last week because it's ostensibly a local issue, but it has a lot of national implications. The New York City City Council passed by veto-proof margins a couple of measures that would end NYPD's very controversial stop-and-frisk policies that have targeted mostly young men of color in that city over the past number of years. They passed one bill to create an inspector general and one bill that expands the definition of racial profiling and allows people who believe they've been profiled to sue police in state court. The NYPD practice of randomly stopping and searching people without any probable cause has been hailed in a lot of places as being a factor in reduction of crime there and has been imitated in cities around the country. The only problem is that something like 87% of the people that they stopped are young men of color. So there is clearly a lot of racial profiling going on in practice, if not in policy. And there's been a lot of political pushback against that, and that finally reached a point this past week where Mayor Bloomberg, who's been an advocate of these policies, even if he vetoes these legislations, they will be upheld by the city council. And they've very explicitly done so based on the idea that this is racial profiling, and they have set up the laws to stop it in a way that if racial profiling is existing, the city can be held financially liable for it, and that will, in fact, put an end to the policies.
That's good news.
Right. Just a few minutes left to cover Egypt.
Yeah, the anti-Mubarak, the anti-Morsi protest that erupted this past week.
There is a difference, oddly enough.
Yes, and the military stepping in and taking Morsi into custody and arresting a number of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood. I want to point out that the anti-Mubarak protests, the ones that pushed Mubarak out of power in 2011, those were never about setting up an Islamic government and trying to impose a version of Sharia law on the Egyptian population. But that's what the Morsi government had been engaged in. And this was not a surprise to me to see that he's now, although it was a bit of a surprise to see him be removed so rapidly by the Egyptian military. Now, the Egyptian military does get about $1.5 billion from the U.S. government every year in military aid. It's the second biggest recipient of military aid from the U.S. in the world behind Israel. And so I saw that and I kind of wondered how much of this was a little bit of nudging from the U.S. government saying, this guy's got to go. We've never liked him. He's an Islamic fundamentalist. Get him out of there.
Yeah. And you also see, you know, the whole dynamic with this. Islamists, of course, are saying, well, we tried this democracy thing and it wasn't respected by the military. And they've thrown us out now. So we need to go back to, you know, calling for a theocracy. But That does something that the United States did for many, many years, especially during the Cold War, which is confusing having an election with democracy. Democracy is more than having an election every few years that elects a leader. You know, it involves a respect for participatory democracy. It involves a respect for everybody being involved,
press
freedoms, freedom of assembly, and so forth.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was not happening in Egypt. And you were seeing a very similar process to what happened during the Iranian Revolution in 1979, where you had the removal of a dictator. A lot of liberal pro-democratic forces coming in being usurped by religious fundamentalists. We saw what happened with that in Iran, where those fundamentalists have since, you know, dominated the country for the last 34 years. And people in Egypt are very concerned that they might be headed down a similar path, and the military stepped in. The United States has been very conspicuous by its ambivalence about this coup. That I don't think they're shedding many tears at all in Washington. And in fact, I would not be at all surprised if there were some long conversations between leadership in the Egyptian military and Washington, D.C. before this took place.
Yeah. And so the next step is that the folks in the street in Egypt have to be pushing for a civilian government to come in and not to allow the military to retain power for too long.
Yeah. And of course, there were a number of clashes overnight because there are plenty of Islamists now in the streets,
mm-hmm.
too.
Events.
Several of them coming up this weekend. Today at 2 o'clock, there will be a rally against U.S. and NATO intervention in Syria, that at Westlake Park downtown. On Monday from noon to 1 o'clock, there will be a rally in solidarity with prison hunger and work stoppage strikes, including one at a facility here in Washington State. That'll be at the outside the King County Jail at 5th and James in downtown Seattle. And then on Wednesday, July the 10th from 6 to 8 p.m., there'll be a fundraiser for New Dawn Guatemala. That'll be happening at Chuck's Hop Shop in Ballard at 656 Northwest 85th.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.